Hello, rap fans. It's Richard Herring here. Thank you for listening to my podcasts, powered by Acast Plus. Do tell your friends if you think they might enjoy them too. And do come and see me on tour in my show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Go to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all tour dates, going to lots of places in the UK. Some extra gigs added in London at the Leicester Square Theatre and the Bloomsbury Theatre. The Leicester Square Theatre first gig is very nearly sold out, so do rush along to those shows, London, if you want to come along. Some of the shows selling fantastically well, some of them selling pretty badly. Hello, Swindon. Do you know I'm coming to your town? Please buy some tickets. And I do have to give a trigger warning. I've done the show only a few times and 6 men have passed out. After the bit where I explain what happens to you during an operation for testicular cancer. So, are you man enough to handle my balls? Only come if you are, have lots of balls and are not scared of balls. There is some mild testicle trauma involved in this story of testicular cancer. It's mainly funny, though, and if you don't come, that means you're scared to come, and I'm going to judge you, so... It's like going on a fairground ride, so do come along. It's going to be very exciting to see if you make it through. I'll give you a badge if you make it through unscathed. Anyway, come and see the tour, richardherring.com for all that news. Some great Rahalastapas coming up, I have to tell you, in the next few weeks. The tour was a lot of fun. Thanks very much to everyone who came. Sit back, relax, and enjoy my stupid fucking podcast.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hello, my fan friends. Welcome to another episode of Rahalastapa, this week with the monumental and legendary American scriptwriter Nell Scovell. If you don't know her name, you have definitely laughed at some of her jokes. This book, Just the Funny Parts, is amazing. And we have 20 copies of this to give away to 20 eager beavers. If you would like a free copy of Just the Funny Parts, please email herring1967@gmail.com. with your address so I can post it to you, and the first 20 people who answer this question correctly and spell it correctly will get a book. If you don't hear from me and you don't get a book, you were too late. That's basically the answer. I'll have put it in the bin, in a big burning bin. Please answer this question. For which legendary comedian slash actor did Nell write a spec script that got her on her way to being a TV scriptwriter? Must be spelled correctly. Check it carefully. You're not Chris Evans, not that one. Make sure you get the name spelt right. First 20 answers that are correct will win a fantastic copy of this book. I'll probably chuck in some other stuff for you as well. I'm a nice guy. I'm paying the postage. What can I say? I've bought the books as well. I'm a great guy. Anyway, I hope you are enjoying my moustache. By the time you see this, it should be a little bit better than this. I'm recording this a couple of weeks before. If you would like to donate to my Movember campaign, please head to rahalastapa.co.uk/Movember with a little ma. Or you can subscribe as a badger at gofasterstripe.com/badges, and all November badge money will go to Movember. Or you can subscribe on Twitch, twitch.tv/rkherring. If you're with Amazon Prime, that is absolutely free. You can give £3.50 for nothing. And that money from November will go to Movember. Also, worth checking out the Twitch channel. Ali and Herring's Twitch are fun, a lot of fun. It's on YouTube if you want to catch up. It's also a podcast. I'm doing snooker and I'm doing stone clearing occasionally as well. So come and join the fun. Just follow me on there, and you'll get notifications whenever I am going live. Right, let's sit back, relax, and enjoy Roller Bar with Nels Gavel. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome a man whose book is out tomorrow. It's Richard Herring. Hello. Welcome to Richard Herring's lockdown second time podcast. I told you it was coming, and here it is. Though I was hanging out with the 50,000 people who voted for Kanye West today, and they didn't know what the fuck was going on or what anything was called, to be fair. They didn't know where up from down. But one bloke I spoke to had written in Rahalastapa. So there we go. It's all good. Yes, my book is, I'll go straight to the book. It's out. I saw it in the wild just before the lockdown. My publication date was the 5th of November and lockdown starts on the 5th of November. So I thought I wouldn't get the pleasure of seeing my book in an actual shop, at least for a month. But, there was one in Waterstones in Hitchin, and there it is. It looks like it's not on its own pile. There was one copy. I couldn't find one anywhere else. It looks like someone had picked it up and thought, nah, and then just thrown it on the pile of the books that people have paid to put on the table. But that's fine by me. That's still on the table, and it still counts. So you can buy that now, and it will be with you tomorrow if you're very lucky. So what's been going on? Biden, Trump, as we record, is undecided. It's looking like it's edging towards Biden. Last night, I didn't want to go to sleep because every time in 2016 that I went to sleep, it seemed like one thing was going to happen. And then when I woke up, something terrible had happened. We'd entered the dark timeline. This time I woke up and Biden was quite a long way ahead. And then within about the half an hour, Trump had caught up. So it's still, I still think it's me sleeping that is causing the problem. I will try not to sleep ever again during any of these things. And fingers crossed we get there. A lot of controversy this week on Taskmaster. I'm on Taskmaster. I don't know if I've mentioned it. Channel 4, 9 o'clock on Thursdays. I had to do a film where I was upside down, and I thought I did a pretty good job. There's me on a ceiling. That is me upside down. Very good special effects. No one could work out how the light bulb is so straight and wonderful. But Greg Davis gave me 1 point, and it still hurts. And if that becomes crucial at the end of the series, I tell you, what I've decided to do, I'm just declaring myself the winner of Taskmaster now, even though I'm slightly behind, and I'm not letting Channel 4 show any of the other episodes. And if they do, I'm going to take them to the Supreme Court, which I've loaded with Richard Herring fans. So it's going to be fine. they love Rahalastapa in the Supreme Court. And I have been, last bit of stand-up, I've been watching, I've been catching up on Star Wars with my daughter, my five-year-old daughter. She's watching it for the first time. Actually, for episodes 2 and 3, I'm watching it for the first time. I never bothered after the disappointment of episode 1. I mean, you know, that's the fifth, you know what I'm talking about, the fourth one. But my problems with the Revenge of the Sith I picked up the wrong paper. There it is. That's good. In the scene where the Emperor appears as a hologram to the separatist leaders. And he says very pointedly during that, he says, Darth Vader will take care of you. But he does it in such a way that it clearly means that Darth Vader is going to kill them. I said to my wife, so Darth Vader is going to kill them then. I know this isn't very topical satire, but the way he says, Darth Vader will take care of you, they should have 100% replied, why did you say that in that weird way, Emperor? I didn't. Oh, you did. Those air quotes all over that sentence. Is Darth Vader going to kill us? No. You're even saying no sarcastically. Jesus, why were you prepared to blow your entire plan for the sake of making an actually pretty lame joke? I mean, get behind it. You can deliver it without lacing it in irony. And believe me, as we're being slaughtered, we'd be thinking, oh, when he said take care of us, he meant take care of us. But now, because of your insistence on making a Dr. Evil star rubbish joke, we're bolting the doors and not letting that cunt in. You're a rubbish evil emperor. So that is my... Maybe too late. I may be too late with the Revenge of the Sith material, but I've just watched it for the first time. Why does Obi-Wan Kenobi not kill Darth Vader when he's down all burnt? There's some spoilers here if you haven't seen it. It seems cruel. He's burnt up and you should just put him out of his misery. I've got a lot of problems with the film, is all I'm saying. And it's disgraceful. Anyway, enough of that. Enough of my hilarious half cobbled together stand up. My guest this week, very excited, come in. It's NY meets NH, New York meets North Hertfordshire.
which is not quite as cool, to be fair. Let's pretend North Hampshire is a very cool place to be. My guest this week is probably best known for writing the sitcom Three Girls and a Genie, that the pilot was not picked up. Will you please welcome the fantastic Nell Scovell, ladies and gentlemen. Here she is. How are you doing? Hello. Lovely to see you. Very glamorous for 3 o'clock in the afternoon.
A little sparkly.
It's lovely. You look fantastic. You've written so many amazing things, and I'm sorry, it's just my hilarious joke that I do at the start of every episode. But I'm quite intrigued by Three Girls and a Genie. I know you liked the sitcom I Dream of Genie.
Yes.
And I wonder what I like about your book we'll get to is you do list everything you've ever written in the back. And some things successful, some things not. Was Three Girls and a Genie a good concept? Were you proud of it?
I was.
Do you remember it?
We're proud of all our children.
Yeah.
And I do think wish fulfillment is always a great source for comedy and drama.
Yeah. Yep.
So
there was three girls, and do they live in a flat? I'm writing a sitcom. Well, I've written a pilot of it, and it's been turned down by the TV. But I'm trying to put it together myself. But it has got a sort of genie in it, but it's about alternate universes, so it's a sort of sci-fi sitcom where the genie can take you to different universes where everything happens. So it's a similar, it's that similar concept of someone who can make your dreams or your nightmares come true. Is that why were there three? Well, I just want to know about that. Let's talk about Three Girls and a Genie for the entire. Who were the three girls? How did they meet a genie?
They were college students, and they
sounds good.
They had to decorate their dorm, and one had found this lamp in the thrift store and thought it was it would be a good addition. And if I remember, it was sort of that classic: one was rich, and one was poor, and one was middle class. And I don't remember much. I mean, it is interesting though that probably Sabrina the Teenage Witch is I created that show, and it was a big hit. And so I was kind of in the right area.
Yeah. Well, I like that. Well, Sabrina's is a very subversive and funny. I mean, it was out here as a sort of kid show, and I suppose it was a sort of teenager's young person show, but it was it had a very adult sensibility behind it as well. And I think you could be fooled into thinking, oh, well, that's something. And then when you watched it, it was a fairly subversive comedy show, right?
It was. And I think, we did one episode where there were truth sprinkles. Sabrina wants to know if the boy she likes her. So her aunt gives her truth sprinkles, and they're all making bundt cakes in home economics, and she puts the truth sprinkles on. And of course, she picks up her shaker and puts them on all the different bundt cakes so that everyone in the entire school is now telling the truth. And I wanted to be honest, it was a kid's show, but I really wanted to portray the real world. And so the moral of that story was not we should tell the truth all the time, but wouldn't the world be a horrible place if everyone told the truth all the time?
Which is good, because I think, again, in the 90s, there was a lot of most American, especially kids' TV shows, would end with that horrible cloying message, or sometimes all the way through a horrible kind of cloying. Like you'd sometimes get a serious episode of Different Strokes, wouldn't you, where they would discuss something very, very, very dark, but also there was always like a message at the end of those, Saved by the Bell, even those sort of things. So when you're up against Saved by the Bell, I mean, this was Chekhov compared to Saved by the Bell, right?
Well, it's why The Simpsons, I think, was so enticing. I mean, it blew my mind the first time I saw The Simpsons, and I remember the very first episode. Homer's taken the family to Mr. Burns' mansion for a company picnic. and the kids go running off and Homer screaming after them, "Be normal." And I just thought it was the funniest thing because like sitcoms just didn't have that kind of edge. You know, if you were a father, you were going to give good advice and you were going to hug your kid and you were going to be Bill Cosby, which turned out so great. But The Simpsons had it right. For any of us who now have children, like screaming "be normal" is way closer to the truth.
The curse of the writer is that people obviously are unaware of us and you, you know, but if you tell people what you've done, so mention The Simpsons, you wrote what an episode of The Simpsons that I think everyone will remember and be able to quote bits off by heart. There's one of my absolute favorite bits in this episode, which is the blowfish one fish, two fish, blowfish, bluefish, where Homer eats some blowfish that he thinks is poisoned and has to make the last 24 hours of his life count.
Well, what's amazing is it was early enough. It was the second season of the show. And one of the reasons they liked this pitch was it allowed us to get to know Homer better. Because the question was, what would you do if you knew you had 24 hours to live? Or as it turns out, 22 hours, because the doctor keeps him waiting for 2 hours in the waiting room. But and now that the show's been on 30 years, it's kind of unthinkable that we wouldn't know everything about Homer.
Sure.
I wrote a new episode that's going to
happen. Heard. Yeah. So there's a new episode coming. So this is your second episode, like 20, 30 years apart.
30 years apart. Right? They told me I now hold the record for the longest amount of time between writing episodes. So I'm quite proud of that.
Sorry, not sorry. It's called, is it? So I have a feeling this is it going to, let me get, is Lisa going to be at the center of this one? And it's going to, it's going to feature her standing up for women's rights.
More complicated than that.
Okay.
But they did come to me because I had just gone through, an experience where I received an apology from David Letterman. I don't know. Do people in England know?
They probably don't. They might know this story. Tell this story for us, because I think that's
Letterman. Like he's okay. So
we know who Letterman is. We know who Letterman is.
It's a very long story.
It is a very long story, but basically,
Read my book to get the
read
full
the book.
Thing.
Here's the book. It's absolutely fantastic, and if you're a writer especially, it will make you feel a lot better. But if you're a comedy fan, it's a great look at the way things work. But yes, you revealed how there was a sort of a toxic atmosphere at Letterman, just in that he was the boss and I think people know that he admitted that he was sleeping with his employees, which
but it went beyond that. There were he was on the air for over 30 years and they never hired a single writer of color. In 30 years, there were only 9 women and well over 100 men. And those 9 women, some of them never lasted more than 6 weeks. And, it was a very, and the show went off the air in 2016, 2015? Right. It's not like this, we're talking about the dark ages. So, it wasn't on the DuPont network in the 50s. So. I spoke.
You've been
out
at the forefront of the change in terms of making people aware of writers' rooms not being fair and other things that we are more more aware of.
It just makes it funnier when you have more points of view
I agree. I've done. I do panel shows, and the radio ones tend to have a balance and of sexes, and it's much better. And I did a writers' room, which is my first time I've done one. I helped the female cause because I got sacked for not being good enough. But it was 50-50 male and female. And it was
being a mediocre brilliant. Male is not good enough anymore. I'm so sorry.
I was sacked. I was thrown off. And I said, that's for you. That's one for the ladies. That's what I said as I left. No, they just rung me up and told me they weren't using my script and didn't invite me back.
But I do want to be clear, I think women and men can write for any gender. Sure. I just think you bring different experiences to the table. And I tell the story in my book about being on the show called Warehouse 13. I don't know if you got it.
I don't think we did get Warehouse 13,
it's
but
really
things
a good
sort of
show. Look it up. And it was on the Sci-Fi Network. I write a lot of genre. I love Black Mirror. I would love to write for Black Mirror. And you know, in the show, I did an episode where one of the main characters, the female, becomes magically pregnant, and I was getting notes on a call from 8 different people. We had the studio, we had the network, and I realized I was the only one who had ever been pregnant.
Right.
And so one of them commented, I had this a running joke about, because when I was pregnant, you get this very acute sense of smell. And he was like, is that really a thing? Are you making that up? So
yeah, well, it is. Yeah, it's crazy when you look, and even here in the UK, and even like you say, 10 years ago, you'd go into a room of all university educated white men, middle class, and it was the same sort of guys. And so, yeah, obviously it makes drama and comedy more interesting to have shared experiences. But
you mean that's half the population? Yeah.
Yeah, well, and, you know, and also different types of people. That's what it just sort of, and I think in the UK, stand-up comedy kind of all morphed around white men for much too much in the 90s. And then now it's, you know, we're getting a lot more different voices. And I think America's been better for that in terms of stand-up, in terms of most, you know, certainly for, I mean, different ethnicities,
yeah.
Maybe not for females, but certainly for in the last 5 or 10 years, I think nearly all the good stand-ups who come through in the UK have been women. And that's because, you know, it's just a slightly nicer environment for them. They've been welcome. But there we go. Yes. But what I love about the book are many things. I mean, there's lots of great advice for writers, which we'll get to. But it is that bit at the back where it just makes you, you know, I've written loads of scripts and a few of them have been made. But you've written, as I say, these massive successful scripts. Just that the Simpsons bit I was going to quote from that episode, which I believe you wrote this line, because obviously there is a team working on these shows in America. But it's when Homer goes for the kids are in bed and he's going, goodbye, Maggie, you're so sweet. Lisa, you've made me proud. Bart, I love your sheets. That is one of the classic Simpsons lines. I think it's one of the top 10 episodes of The Simpsons, isn't it? And when it's voted. So they should have had you back before 30 years. but you list everything you've done, and, you know, and there's many, many of these things didn't get beyond pilot, not piloted, or piloted and not made. And that's the life of a writer, isn't it? I think this is what this book shows, that even if you've had early success and you've had continued success through your life, you've run your own shows, you've worked in lots of different genres, and yet still you can't be... the Lean In thing, where you wrote Lean In, which is this huge book with the
Sheryl Sandberg. I helped Sheryl Sandberg write that.
And the book was a huge success. Then it says the film, Lean In, didn't get commissioned. You go,
that
what?
Was such a good script. That one hurt.
Yeah.
That one really hurt.
Which of all these shows that didn't get made and films that didn't get made would you most like to see get made? Is there a favorite script?
Oh, absolutely the Lean In movie. We did a table read with Kristen Bell, who was fantastic, and Bradley Whitford was there too. I'm trying to remember who else. There were some really great people, and it was delightful. And I will never understand. We went back, lots of big laughs, and we went back to the executive's office, and they looked at me and said, "Well, obviously, we're not going to make it." What? Did you just see? So I don't know. It's such
but
a
But how does that
business.
Not get that? You know, that's just astonishing. How does something, you just look at that and go, well, if the book's been that big a smash, why didn't Facebook just make it? Why didn't Facebook just give you the money and make it themselves?
Well, they were not in the content business at the time.
Okay. Yeah.
But you know what? Your the line I think of most often in Hollywood comes from Elvis Costello. And it's, I used to be disgusted, now I try to be amused. And that's gotten me through so much.
Yeah. Well, that's because I just through the noughties and probably the last 10, 15 years, I was getting, you know, it's lovely to get commissioned to write scripts. I was getting paid to write scripts. But every time, you know, you would get not the, the the people in charge would change just as you're about to hand it in, so you were scuppered, or it just wouldn't get there. And now you put so much into a script, right? Do you feel that? I mean, I feel like it feels, and I have babies now, and I always used to say it feels like babies. It's not the same, but the emotional investment in it is huge, and you've put a lot of time and effort into it and made it as good as you can. And then for it just to be sort of stamped on is... it's psychologically very hard to recover from that, isn't it? So how is that? You just, are you able to brush it off and move on to the next thing? I mean, clearly you are, because you write so much.
Well, I mean, I talk a lot in the book about how I sort of learned not to get too invested and yeah. not to, you know, to kind of numb it down so that the highs aren't high and the lows aren't low, and you just kind of approach it professionally. I don't think there's wasted scripts. I learn something every time I write a script. So I never feel like I wasted my time or, you know, if you're getting paid, then you're like, well, I knew the odds going in. But I do, you know, I like writing. So that makes it a lot easier.
Yeah, I mean, I do when it's going well, and you're so prolific. I find I get disheartened, and I think it's partly down to possibly the difference between the UK and US systems, which I'm quite interested in that the US sitcoms are often written by a team. You'll be brought a lot of these things. You've been brought in to write an episode or to come and help just punch up other people's scripts, or you'll write a script, and other people will punch it up. Do you think that I'm very good when there's a deadline and I can write very quickly. And I wrote a sitcom that I had to basically write an episode a week on my own. And then it was made. Oh,
that'll
week.
Make you a good writer.
Yeah. Well, it was pretty good, although it burnt me out for a bit. And also I earned some money, so I didn't feel the need to work so hard. But do you think, because as a UK writer, it's a lot of sitting on your own, just trying to get stuff done. Is how much of your life is sitting on your own trying to get stuff done, and how much of it is in a room full of people sort of knocking stuff back and forth?
You know, the grass is always greener. So when you're in a room, you think, oh, I just want to be off writing my own thing. And when you're off writing your own thing, you're like, oh, this would be so much more fun if I were in a room. And I actually, so I like bouncing between both because it really does make me appreciate what's good about the other situation.
Yeah. And you find it quite, I think you find it quite easy to write. I mean, I've heard you on one of the other podcasts I was listening to saying, you know, it's not writing a sitcom. It's only half an hour, 20 minutes. It's not that hard. And people take 6 months writing a sitcom episode. And how quickly can you generally write a sitcom episode once something's up and running?
Oh, you know, in a weekend if I have to.
Really? Yeah.
Yeah. But I talk about in the book how there are three elements to every room. There are the people, the product, and the process. So the people is, you know, who you're working for, what the atmosphere is like. Are you working, you know, with people who respect you, who are just nice to hang out with? The processes, are the hours long? Is the studio throwing out scripts? And then the product is, you know, is it a show you're proud of? Is it Monk or The Simpsons, or is it a show like NCIS or Charmed, which people really like, but it was not my favorite show I worked on.
Okay.
And the truth is, when you look at, when I went back while writing my book and looked at people, product, and process, most shows I worked on had one.
Yeah.
I felt I was lucky when I had two, and there were only two shows I'd ever worked on that had all three, where I was really happy and proud of all three.
Which two were those? So Sabrina, I'm guessing?
Sabrina, yeah. When I was the boss, I happened to be very happy. And then Murphy Brown, which was a real delight, and the cast was very professional. And interestingly, so that was a long time ago, that writing room, we're still all friends.
Right.
And it was also the first time I was in a writer's room with other women. And it was a 40-60 split. One of the executive producers was a woman. And I think it actually made it a more enjoyable experience for everyone. That it,
sure.
it resembled the real world more than some of these kind of locker room shows.
Yeah, because I guess some of those rooms, if it gets competitive, or sometimes a personality clash can be great for writing comedy, but I guess if you're there for a year working on a sitcom and come back every week, that personality clash becomes a bit much to bear. if it's a room view. But yeah,
there's always like the asshole. Almost yeah. always there's one person who you go, oh, if it just weren't for that person, this would be so good. And
that's what they did on my sick. They got rid of the asshole on my one. So that was, they took me out. And then I think since then it's been just running so smoothly.
I did once write a movie that was all about, it was about a man who gets promoted and he has to fire a bunch of people. And his whole arc is him realizing, when did I become the asshole? But well, they didn't make that one either.
More men need to realize that, wouldn't it? That's what my books are.
I mean, if you're good at your job, eventually you do become the asshole.
Sure. I suppose. I think it doesn't seem to me. I mean, admittedly, I mainly know you from reading a book that you've written about yourself. But you don't seem to. You seem to be a very grounded and interesting person. And you know, you don't seem to be that. I don't think you're an asshole, though. You know, you may have left those things out.
This is a little bit of a segue, but you'll understand what got me here. So it's hard to write a memoir, and certainly when you're a woman and you sort of grow up, like nobody wants to hear your voice. And I was always kind of the little brown mouse in the corner. It would be hard. And I'd hit days when I'd be like, I don't know why I'm writing this. Does anyone care? And then I would remember that Christopher Hitchens was the same age as me when he wrote his memoir. Right. And I was like, I bet he never had a moment of self-doubt. I bet he never took a second to wonder if people wouldn't be fascinated with his life. And that would propel me forward.
Good. Well, I'm glad it did, because it's honestly, I mean, I know it's been out for a couple of years, but I would advise everyone to get it. If you're a comedy fan, which people watching this will be, if you're a comedy writer, you definitely need it. It's full of good advice.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
There's some good stuff. Well, let's talk about the Gary Shandling show, which astonishingly, I mean, this is what I find it. You basically asked to write a Simpsons script and you were allowed to do it. And I know it was early on, but that was sort of crazy. But this was your first sitcom script. You just on spec wrote an episode of the Gary Shandling show, which was his first TV show before Larry Sanders, which went on to be more better known. But absolutely, that I think Larry Sanders is up there as possibly the best ever sitcom. But I also loved the Gary Shandling show, which was again literally taking out the fourth wall. And in the UK, Sean's show turned out to be very similar afterwards, which was obviously heavily influenced by it. But it's an incredible show. But you just sent in a script which they liked enough to sort of fly you over to meet them, right? Which is astonishing.
Yeah, it was supposed to be a work session, but Gary wasn't in the mood to work, so we ended up playing ping pong.
And
it was a perfect introduction to Hollywood because nothing went as planned. But it was the start of my career. And when people ask, how should I start writing for TV? I always say, pick a show that you really like, that you think suits your sense of humor. Because The Shandling Show wasn't that popular, but I sat down and wrote one because I got that humor. It was really funny to me. And there were people like Gary Shandling and Albert Brooks. It was Albert Brooks's movie, Real Life. I don't know if people know that one in the UK.
Not so much, I don't think. Yeah, I've heard you talk about it, but I've not seen it, so I must check it out.
It's so good, and you'll see he doesn't wink at the camera. It's pure character comedy, and that was my favorite, as opposed to, someone like Woody Allen, who's just cracking jokes, and I like that too. Before he started dating his daughter, but. The more subtle character comedy is really, the best.
Was that a bit of a mind fuck to suddenly find yourself? If it had been me and Gary Shandling had been in, even at that stage, and Gary Shandling had been interested in my script and giving you compliments, did you take that in your stride, or were you thinking, how the fuck has this happened?
I had this whole other profession. I was a magazine writer.
Sure.
In fact, your friend Tina Brown had hired me for Vanity Fair when I was in my 20s. And I only thought of TV because I bumped into a friend who was an editor one day, and she said to me, "I don't mean this as an insult, but I think you could write for TV." And it hadn't occurred to me. I'd grown up on the East Coast. I'd lived in Boston and New York. And at the time, I was like, wow, I guess people do write for TV. So I like TV.
Yeah.
So everything, even to this day, everything seems like gravy to me with television.
Do you get starstruck, though? Because I think I always did get, I'd always get a little bit starstruck. I heard there was a story, I think, from the Vanity Fair party.
Oh, yeah.
You were telling about Colin Firth, who I also sat behind him at a pantomime and recognised him, but couldn't think of his name. So I was Googling him, but I'm really terrified that he would look and see. I think he might have been actually sitting next to me, and I was Googling him to try and find out his name. I could remember everything he was in, and then but I couldn't think of his name. That's quite bad. But you had a
Oh, I humiliated myself in front of Colin.
Which is it's enjoyable. Tell us about that.
So I used to, because I had written for Vanity Fair for a very long time, I still do, I would get invited to their big Oscar parties. So, it was above my pay grade, but I was basically the help. And one evening that year that Colin Firth won for The King's Speech, I was actually waiting for my car at the valet when he and his all-female entourage came out to get their car. Now, obviously, they were not going to wait. They pulled the limo right up. But Colin Firth, ever the gentleman, opens the car door, and he's letting the ladies in. And as he does it, he turns, and he and I make eye contact. Like, I'm having a moment with Colin Firth on the greatest night of his life. And we're just feet apart, and I feel like I should say something. So I do, and what I say is, "Well done, Mr. Darcy." And he goes like this. And he, shoves the last woman in and gets in, and he slams the door. And they drive off, and I was just like, what have I done? So I called my sister the next morning, and I was like, I tell her that story, and she goes, "Don't you know he hates to be reminded of that role?" And she said he was just interviewed for the LA Times, and he mentioned it. And I was like, I had no idea. I feel terrible. And my sister, who is like a great Bennett sister, says, well, don't feel bad. If he didn't like being associated with that role, he should stop playing it so much.
But it's also true. I mean, this is something that's come up a few. I had Michael Palin on a few months ago, the last show before lockdown, the first lockdown. And he was so delighted to reminisce about, you know, I thought, oh, you won't want to talk about this or that. But he started doing bits of the sketches and he was so happy. It made him so happy. And you kind of think there's two kind of personalities in showbiz. The people who go, oh, that thing made me successful. But now it's a weight around, it's an albatross around my neck, literally for John Cleese. And people who kind of revel in it, which is what you should do, because that is why he's there. That's why he's won for the King's Speech, even though he isn't Mr. Darcy in the King's Speech for once.
But Richard, Michael Palin, you asked me a question earlier. Can I repeat it? About, was there something as a child I didn't like that as an adult? I didn't appreciate Michael Palin when I first started watching Monty Python. I mean, I liked him, but John Cleese and Terry Gilliam Terry Jones were much broader and funnier. And then as an adult, you start watching and you're like, Michael Palin is brilliant in everything.
He's
so good. So there's your answer.
Yeah, well, that's good. I'm glad that was a question for the backstage. If you become a badger and you can see the question. Yeah, he's definitely, I'm the same way. You know, obviously, I think as a kid, you're looking at John Cleese, and John Cleese is the standout kind of larking, funny walk guy, and very funny. Though, but also it's every single step of their career. I was watching John Cleese. He's on Cameo, which I've become quite obsessed with, where Michael Ian Black's on Cameo as well. I keep making him do cameos for me because he'll do it for $85. So you know what Cameo is? It's where you can get a message from a celebrity. So you just say, email in and say, pay $85 or whatever. I think for John Cleese, it's $265. And he'll give you a message. But I looked at one of John Cleese's ones and he was just eating some food. His head was right at the bottom. And he was just eating some food. I thought, this is a come down for Basil Fawlty, isn't it? This is a man who did all this amazing work. And Michael Palin is, I think, absolutely. He's my absolute. I asked him to be my dad. He accepted. I don't know how it's going to work out this Christmas. I'm going around at Christmas to see. The social distancing is going to be a problem. But
And of course, these celebrities, they give the money to charity.
Not John Cleese. I think some people do. Michael Ian Black doesn't. I used to do two. I'm going to do, thing is, I didn't pay him for being on the podcast, so I'm going to do four. I'm going to give him four cameos. So they crop up in this every
All right.
Now.
Well, just buy a bunch of my books for your friends Christmas.
It's so good. And some of the advice that came out, I think this was, this is just all the way through. There's these great advice, and this is what you got from the Gary Shandling show. I think this was maybe Albert Brooks said this to you, did he? The three things: never be afraid to write on spec, don't ask friends for work, and take any job that comes your way. You never know where it might lead. And those are such clever bits of advice for a new writer, I think, don't you? Because I think so many people write to me and say, I've written a film and can you get this to someone who can make it? And I go, I can't get my own stuff made. I don't know why you're sending this to me, but you know, why are you starting with a film? Why are you starting, you know, it might work out for you, but really, you know, it's exactly what you did, isn't it? You wrote on something on spec and it led to other things.
Right.
And you took work that wasn't your first choice, but led to other things.
Well, I think you never know what you're good at often till you try. And one of the other pieces of advice that I deeply believe, and I tell it to a lot of young women who might be afraid to take a risk or not be good at something, I say, if it's something new, like, what have you got to lose? If you're great at it, then you just learned an incredible piece of information. And if you're not good at it, you can just say, hey, I never did it before. What did you expect? And that has served me well.
Yeah. It is. Well, it's sort of, but it's interesting. And, you know, I do, having talked to a lot of people, the kind of way in is often seems just from the outside, you think, could that work? Would writing a script for Gary Shandling and sending it to him, would that work? Or, you know, or just happen to meet someone. But, you know, that's more likely to work than just sitting at home going, what do I have to do? Who, you know, or just emailing people and asking them, how do I get on? You know, just I suppose it's being proactive. The interesting one of those pieces of advice, I think, is don't ask friends for work, which isn't, you know, isn't something you would implicitly put as your number two piece of advice, but it's actually a really clever piece of advice as well, right?
Well, the two things I want to say about that is, one, he said, because your friends know if you're available, and if they wanted to hire you, they would.
Yeah.
And the second thing is, I think it was a message to me. I'm like, don't ask. So it worked on a couple of
levels
there. But the other thing is, so I wrote this spec. It sold, but then it wasn't made. And then there was a lull. I had to write another spec. And, you know, it was not like rocket ship. You know, it was start and stop. And I really believe that I just got enough positive reinforcement along the way to keep me going.
Sure. Yeah. But I think also there was just something in you that was pushing you on to do it. And I think that's the main thing anyone in this business I think needs, is just sort of the desire to do it. So it feels to me like you would have written a Gary Shandling script for, you know, even if it wasn't going to be sent in, you would have written a script for The Simpsons. You got enough pleasure out of doing those jobs that even had they not been made, or if they, which were, I mean, the Gary Shandling wasn't made, but you were paid for it. You know, it would have been an interesting experience for you. So I think it is about, you know, the dedication and the interest, I suppose, in it. It's a book that sort of, you know, it's reassuring if you are a writer. It's sort of maybe off-putting if you're not a writer, in that, you know, it's called Just the Funny Parts and a Few Hard Truths About Sneaking into the Hollywood Boys Clubs is the subheading. And, it is about the hard times as well. And so you give this four stages of the Hollywood writer, which is near the beginning, which is, you know, which is, who is Nell Scovell? Get me Nell Scovell. Get me a younger Nell Scovell. Who is Nell Scovell? So those are the four. And what I liked was you put
a
warning that,
cheaper Nell
Scovell. Yeah, younger, cheaper. A warning that prepares you for a tragedy while doing nothing to prevent it.
And then you get old and you loop around again to who is Nell Scovell? You're lucky.
It's full of stuff like that. It's good, but it's sort of reassuring. But also, I'd say that the chapter about The Simpsons, which again, we won't go into now, but if you read that, if you're interested in the mechanics of how a Simpsons episode was put together in those early days, and the back and forth, and how you created the streetcar named Desire together in the room, and then that was rejected for this episode, but went on to be another very successful episode as well. And that's that. I suppose that's where, I mean, The Simpsons is an interesting show, right? Because there's 200 episodes that probably rank up with the greatest stuff ever, and then there's another 200 episodes where, you know, it can't possibly keep up that level of, or can it? I mean, I don't watch it as much as I did now, but I'll definitely watch yours. I've got them all. They're all on Disney Plus. I'm going to watch every single one from start to finish. But
my favorite things was when I worked on Warehouse 13. There was a younger writer who was in his 20s. He was a story editor. And we got along great. And basically, he'd grown up watching The Simpsons. Yeah. So his sense of humor was exactly like mine. So even though we were from really different backgrounds, I felt like I had kind of helped raise him.
Yeah. it's been around for so long that it absolutely, you know, people have grown up to it. I've been showing my daughter it. And, you know, she loves certain things about it that a five-year-old can get. So it works for the whole family, and it is. And I think those early episodes, I guess it's partly that passion of the writers. I think partly just because it concentrates so much on that family unit. It's what you liked about it when you saw it. I think it's this dysfunctional family, but it's about the love that binds them together despite everything, but then also pushes them apart. You know, it's
also very freeing because it's animation. So,
sure.
You know, when you're back then, there weren't that many single camera shows. They were these three camera shows, and you were locked into your three sets, and then you had your one swing set. Then suddenly you get to write animation, and, you know, Barney's in jail and Homer gets a flat tire, and, you know, you're just all over the place.
Yeah. But I think those early ones work because maybe it's because of that, you know, that passion where you're creating three episodes out of one episode. But also, there's just something, it's more simple. They didn't, you know, almost make jokes in the early episodes about we're not going off on crazy adventures. You know, this is where we introduce. There was one episode that when we introduced the crazy space character who comes in, and they did lots of things where they parodied other cartoons failing to carry on. I mean, it's such an incredible achievement to have a show that's run that long, and it's such an incredible achievement to, you know, have two scripts and not be on the team. You know, you're not on the team now, but you can just whenever you want, you could just nip in and go, all right, I would love to write an episode of The Simpsons. I'd love to write an episode of The Gary Shandling Show. That's less likely. Probably not going to happen.
I wrote
now.
An episode of The Critic, which nobody's right. seen.
From oh, right, yes. Group. But that was a crossover, right? The Critic turns up in one episode of
The
Simpsons.
No, The Critic was for ABC. It was a whole different thing. But that was that. It might not be as well known. Well, there was a movie about it. So my episode aired opposite Nancy Kerrigan and Tonya Harding skating in the Olympics.
Oh, right.
Against each other. And it was literally, this isn't hyperbole, the lowest rated primetime show in ABC history at the time.
But like, there's lots, because I've been listening to lots of podcasts.
You can't get too invested in any of these.
I know. But you pop up, what is just amazing. And that's what's, I think, it's sort of interesting, I think, from an outside perspective, this book, because, you know, most people won't necessarily know your name, but they will know the stuff you've done. And you sort of pop up in the last three decades, you pop up and you've got a hand in nearly everything. I don't think it's in the book, but you mentioned on a podcast working with Larry David, and you came up with the idea of him taking flowers from the roadside memorial.
I don't like to talk about that because it's such an evil thing to do.
I know, but
I
it's
tell people that, and they just look at me like, "Who are you? Why would you ever think of that?"
But the thing is that you thought of it and didn't do it. That's the thing. So, and that's what the writer is, right? So you think of it, go, "Whoa!" I mean, if you're getting
David would do.
It would be funny, but like that's what a writer's room often is, isn't it? I mean, in the writer's room, it seems to me there's ideas thrown up that you know can never ever be said anywhere outside of the room.
I was the one who gave Miss Piggy her tail, was responsible for us seeing Miss Piggy's tail for the first time. It's canon now. There was a question about whether Miss Piggy would have a tail or not. Yeah. She does.
And why did you make that decision? Remind me, because that's in the book.
I wanted to do an episode. Remember, I don't know if you know that, the Janet Jackson nipple incident when she had the wardrobe malfunction. So I was working on the reboot of The Muppets, and it was a more adult show. And I thought, well, what if Miss Piggy were on the red carpet and she had a wardrobe malfunction and we saw her tail? And I went to the main Muppet guy and I was like, well, does Miss Piggy have a tail? And he said, I don't know. And he said, well, I guess so. And I said, have we ever seen it? And he said, no. And I said, could we see it? And he just got the biggest smile because he just all clicked in. And it's a really sweet episode because, you know, she has to accept that her pigginess and be okay with that.
Right. In the book, you say, there's a quote you say about people say to you, it must be so much fun working on the Muppets. And you say, that's one of the great fantasies of Hollywood. So why wasn't it fun working on the Muppets, or was it fun? It sounds like that was fun.
I compare it to being like an Oompa Loompa in Willy Wonka's factory. Like if you're an outsider, you're like, it's all chocolate waterfalls. And, you know, if you're the inside, like you're staying up late cleaning up after the nut cracking squirrels. So, I mean, there were just too many Swedish chefs in the kitchen on that show.
Okay.
So.
Well, yes, that's fair enough. We'll draw a veil over it. But, there's a lot more to talk to you about, but you've also written for, we'll maybe get onto politics in a second, but you've written
anything happening in the political
world? I think something might be going. I was hoping, you know, I was just fingers crossed that America would still be there when we connected and not in flames, which it seems to be as we speak, at least it's not. But you worked with Obama, Barack Obama, and wrote jokes for his speeches.
I was honored. It was never joined the army, but I've done what I could for my country. And you know, he's got Johnny Carson's timing. In fact, he did it. Someone put up a video recently, and they compared it. He had Chris Rock's timing. But maybe he's gotten a little, more savvy. But he was a delight. I've written for Hillary Clinton.
Right.
I wrote jokes for her, and she was great too.
Cool. How'd you go about? How'd you get that gig? Are you sending in jokes on spec to Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, or someone said come and write jokes? Is this through Lean In?
It was complicated. It came in through Facebook, and it was just wonderful timing that I got to write for him. I mean,
do you get to meet him to go, or do you send him a list of jokes, or do you get to chat with him and say, what would you like to, what are you interested in?
No, I mean, I did get to go to the White House and hang out with some of the speechwriters who are just amazing. And they're, in addition to being super smart, they're actually all very, very funny, or at least in Obama's White House, they were. And they went off and did Pod Save America, which has become this huge, successful podcast. But you know, it's so similar to TV writing. And I always think of, like, Barack Obama was the leader of the free world, but he lived with his wife, his mother-in-law, and two daughters, which always felt like a sitcom to me.
Yeah. Whereas I was thinking the sitcom at the moment is the Melania lookalikes at the White House.
Melania.
There should be five Melanias who are all sort of sitting around in the White House waiting for their turn.
Well, even
their relationship with the real Melania, that'd be a good...
Well, real Melania is pretty fake too. So.
That's true. Fingers crossed Donald Trump's won so that what I can pitch that sitcom.
What if it got to, like, you did a sketch where the fake Melanias don't remember which one's the real Melania, and they're trying to figure it out. Maybe that's my Black Mirror episode.
There we go. I think we've got it. Well, I know Charlie Brooker, but you're not allowed to pitch. If you pitch it to him, he can't use it. That's why I pitched him one by a DM, but it was only a sort of joke one about it was like a sex version of The Purge, where you're able to, everyone's allowed to go out and have sex with anyone they want, but it's about people who can't get a babysitter that night and are stuck in the house.
Why aren't you writing that movie right now?
Well, because I just have the ideas, then I'd write them to Charlie Brooker, and he says he can't use them.
Just go back into lockdown. You have no.
We do. Yes, I should. I mean, I'd rather just play with puppets and just things on Twitch. Now I saw a thing that at 54 you lose your get up and go. That's the study that this week on Twitter it came out. And I'm 53, but I think I was reading it in the bath while I was playing some video game in the bath for 2 hours. So I think I may have hit it early.
Kurt Vonnegut said women lose their sense of humor. Really? I think he said at 30. It's like, I'm on borrowed time.
Oh, that's a shame. Kurt Vonnegut was pretty good, but he's my favorite.
I like him.
But then every now and again, a little thing.
But he was a man of his generation.
He was. Exactly. Are we allowed to say that? But I'm a man of my generation. I'm a man of my generation. So how are you feeling? I know you are very well.
The title of my next memoir, A Man of My Generation.
Well, good. We've come up with some good ideas. And how are you feeling about the situation? We're recording this on the 4th of November. It looks like Biden may win, but we've been there before with this sort of thing. I know you were very worried about this when I even said, can you do the 4th of November? You said, you know, that's the day after Election Day. Do you think he's going to be okay? And do you think America's going to be okay?
Well, in the reality show that is Trump's presidency, I feel like we're in the series finale and it's this cliffhanger, but it's a two-parter. So I think we're going to get our happy ending.
Yeah.
But I think people wanted this landslide, this repudiation. The other side's cheating. So the way I compare it is, if you were in a soccer game and the other soccer goal was half the size of yours,
yeah,
and you just said, well, okay, We'll outplay. I guess we just have to outplay you. We'll let you cheat, but we'll outplay you. You know, you can at best squeak out a victory, which I think they're doing, but it's hard to beat people under those circumstances.
Well, it's, I mean, it's both in the UK and America. The, I mean, there's an archaic element to the political systems, I suppose, where, you know, in the UK, because it's all constituencies and you can, you know, people are, a party will get way ahead even though they're getting less votes, which is sort of what's happening. Donald Trump didn't get as many votes as Hillary. Biden's got more votes than anyone's had in history at the moment we're up to. So it's it feels like things need to change, but they see, do you think there's going to be a change, or is it just going to keep on going? It's sort of rolling the other way, and will there be a reaction to that?
It's Putin's world. We just live in it. I mean, it's...
Well, I'm glad things are okay for the moment. I'm glad you're still up and running. So you've got an episode of The Simpsons coming up. Is there anything else in the pipeline that you can talk about, or is it...
No, I'm developing a show with someone for Netflix. And I just wrote a new spec. I always say the day I can't sit down and write a new spec is the day I'm done with Hollywood. So it's still fun for me.
And are you writing more the sort of 60-minute slots now rather than the third to the sort of sitcoms? It moved into more of the longer shows, or are you still...
Well,
you're still,
I've kind of gone back. So
have you?
Sitcoms had gotten really short because there were so many commercials. When I started, a sitcom was 26 minutes and change. Today, they're 22 minutes, 21 minutes once you have your title sequences. And I really felt that limited your stories. But if you go to Netflix, they're half hours.
Sure.
And so you know, just as a percentage of time, you can really develop your characters and do your twists that are fun.
Sure, sure. Although I'm so impressed with some of those American series, because in the UK, I think like the shortest I've had to write is like 24, 25. But in, like something like Rick and Morty, which is the thing I'm obsessed with for the last few years. But anything Dan Harmon's doing, he seems to get so much into those 22, 23 minutes. Sometimes you kind of think when you go back to you go, how the hell was that one episode? There's so much in there. But talking of sci-fi, I did want to ask you about your X-Files. You wrote an episode of the X-Files. And this is a good story to end on, because it's a story of failure. Which is the fate of the writer, even though we've covered most of your successes, I think. But
I was a big fan of the X-Files, and they invited me to pitch ideas for a freelance episode. I pitched to Chris Carter. He really liked one of my ideas. I developed it. They hired me to write it. I wrote a very detailed outline. I turned it in, didn't hear back, which was a little weird. Then my phone rings. It's Chris Carter, and he tells me I have bad news. We just decided to give the one remaining freelance slot to someone else. And I was just taken aback. And then he explained Stephen King had contacted them and asked them to write a script. And so it's pretty hard to be upset about getting replaced by Stephen King. I mean, if you're a writer and you're replaced by anyone, you would want it to be by the most successful writer.
He's done enough, though, hasn't he? He's got enough stuff. Everything's basically a short story. Every film is a short story by Stephen King, it turns out, more or less. So it's a shame.
I mean, the kicker of the story is it turned out to be one of the most hated episodes of all time. And it was not, no one was happy with how it turned out, including Stephen King.
We were obsessed with that, with the X-Files again, early on. Yeah. And when we toured, I was in a double act and we toured in a van and it had a video player in it, which we just couldn't believe. It was a little sort of minivan and had a video player. And we bought the first series of The Simpsons, of the X-Files. And every episode, we would just sing all the way through the title music. The X-Files is on now. And then when it was finished, we were singing, The X-Files is over. And that's my main memory of The X-Files. That and Eugene Toombs. Those are my two memories
of The
X-Files. The
cigarette man. You remember everybody.
Oh, I remember him. And Gillian Anderson was lovely in it. And the guy was, Mulder was okay too. And then they did that song, Mulder and Scully. That was good too. Right.
You know, I always wanted the scene. I always wanted them was to get called back to the home office and get screamed at for their cell phone bills because they were always on their cell phones. And it was back in the day when that was really expensive.
Yeah, this isn't important. You just invade the aliens don't exist. Stop wasting all our money.
This is costing us a fortune. Better find those aliens.
Well, look, it's been an absolute delight to meet you, Nell. I'm a huge fan, and there's so much more we could talk about, but I'm going to let you get back to your political situation and your afternoon in New York. Thanks so much. My wife sends her best. My wife loves you as well.
Oh,
and she wants you to be on her podcast as well. But I might.
Is she on Twitter? Can I follow her?
She's on Twitter. Yeah, she's called Katie Wilkins, I think.
Katie Wilkins?
Wait, Katie Wilkins. Look out for her. She does a podcast called Drunk Women Solving Crime, but you don't have to drink to go on it. You could go on it. I think you'd be very good on it.
I will follow her. Oh, so, and can I say if you want to follow me,
yes.
Nell Sco. So NELLSCO.
Do you regret that decision to miss the VELL off the end now?
So what's weird is I was on Twitter. I was harassed. It was early on.
No.
I left. And when I came back, someone else had taken my name.
So, there can't be another one. Super fan.
I went to them and I said, what's going on? And they were like, I was holding it for you. And I was like, I don't want to deal with you.
I don't want to touch it now. Now you've been holding it. I don't want it anymore. You can keep it. Yeah. I'll just take the veil off. Very well worth following this for comedy and for politics. And do buy Just the Funny Parts, which looks a bit weird on the screen because I've got a green screen behind me now. You don't know what's behind me.
Oh.
You can't see it. I mean, maybe you can see the green screen. So do buy this book. I haven't read many books this year. And it might even been last year I read this one. But it's the best one. This is the best book of the year. Look, you've got it too. And then also, there's this one which doesn't go to the green screen either.
If I looked in a mirror, and it'd be infinity. Anyway, thank you for having me, Richard.
Thanks so much for doing it. We're back next week with Arthur Matthews, who wrote Father Ted. And we've got another writer. It's going to be fantastic. Father Ted, Toast of London, has a new book out as well. So we're going to see him next week. Thank you very much. Watch Ali and Herring's Twitch of Fun tomorrow at 7:30 on this same channel. Thank you very much, everyone. Bye-bye. You have been listening to Rahulastapa with me, Richard Herring, and my guest, Nell Scovell. Thank you to Pest. They do the music. I don't know if I've ever told you that before, but I'm very much indebted to them, as I am to my producer and friend, Chris Evans, not that one. I would also like to thank everyone at Acast, everyone at the British Comedy Guide, Ian Tunes, Ian Apple, Ian Twitch, all the usual suspects. This is a Sky Potato Fuzz and GoFasterStrike.com production. Why not head to GoFasterStrike.com? You can buy the book Problem with Men and get a special book plate with a penis drawn on it and my signature. Plus, it's November the 19th badge. It's got everything you could ever want for a book. The audiobook of The Problem with Men is great as well. And also GoFasterStrike.com/badges, become a monthly badger, or look through GoFasterStrike.com to see all the DVDs and downloads and books you can buy from them by me and other lovely, fantastic comedians. Plus to it. All right, see you later, kids. See you on the flip side.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Thanks for listening. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for all your Rich Herring download and book needs. Go to richherring.com/gigs to find out if Can I Have My Ball Back is coming near to you. And please listen to as many podcasts on this feed as you possibly can. And make your family and friends and children and strangers, make them listen too. Do get consent from everyone before you make them listen, though. All right, thanks for listening. Go and listen to another one. Bye-bye.